Good afternoon. My name is Bill Hempel. As president, past president, honorary member, and chairperson of the Memorial Address Committee, I would like to welcome everyone to the 2009 ASBRS Memorial Address and Awards Program. However, before we go on, I would just like at this time to acknowledge the passing of one of our committee members. Mr. Morris Thompson was a past chairman and longtime member of the Memorial Address Committee. I know he will certainly be missed by all. In the next few minutes, we will be commemorating the technical, administrative, and sometimes very personal accomplishments of a past pioneer and leader in our profession. At the conclusion of the memorial session, we will move to the region and other awards portion of the program. And before we go further now, I'd like to recognize our distinguished guests and ask them to stand. We have past presidents. They have their distinctive badge, as you can see. Honorary members. And I know we have a newly elected honorary, myself, two over here. Fellows. And very good. National officers and members of the board of directors and any national committee chairs. Okay. Region presidents. Very good. And lastly, members of the ASPRS Foundation Board of Trustees, very important group. We also have members of the Southard family with us today, and would they stand, please? They're over here. For those of you who may be first-time attendees at this session, please allow me to relate just a small bit of history. In 1971, the former American Society of Photogrammetry, or ASP as it was known, started the tradition of recognizing outstanding deceased members. This recognition was initially done as a memorial lecture, and subsequent memorials have been presented at each annual meeting. In recent years, the presentation was changed from a lecture to a memorial address, and in some years, two people have been memorialized. Nearly all presentations to date have been published in the Society's journal, PENRS, and those presented from 71 to 86 were published by the ASPRS in a soft cover volume entitled Pioneers in Photogrammetry. Since the Society now has past years of PENRS available on the website, it's possible to go back and review more recent memorial addresses online and usually found in the yearbook issue. Our newer and usually younger members might ask what purpose is served by the ASPRS support and endorsement of these memorial addresses. The Society believes that a strong background in the historical developments of photogrammetry, remote sensing, and other mapping science technologies is important to achieving a well-rounded education and an understanding of just how our profession has evolved. Knowledge of each honoree may also reflect some very personal history involved with the historical developments. Capturing that history is a key means for us to share past accomplishments of leaders in the field with our current and future professionals, and we hope we achieve that purpose through the ASPRS Memorial Address Program. Our presenter for today, Roy Mullen. Roy Mullen is a native of New Jersey. After 4 years of service in the U.S. Marine Corps, from 1942 to 46, he returned to college and graduated from the American University in 1951. Upon graduation, he joined the U.S. Geological Survey, beginning 43 years working for the federal government. He served in the Atlantic Region Office, working in all phases of map production, both in photogrammetry and field operations. He worked for 6 years in the branch of Research and Design, Office of Research and Technical, and served as chief branch of photogrammetry and the headquarters staff from 1969 to 1972. He then joined the executive level and management team of the topographic division, when he was selected as Pacific Region Engineer in Menlo Park, California. He was responsible for all mapping operations in the western United States and the trust territories of the Pacific. He returned to Reston headquarters in 1976 to the position of Assistant Chief Topographic Engineer for Research and Technical Standards, where he led that activity during the transition from graphic map production to digital map domain. In 1980, he was selected as Associate Chief of the National Mapping Division, sharing with the division chief full responsibility for the technical, scientific, and administrative activities of the nation's survey and mapping operations. He received the Department of the Interior's Meritorious and Distinguished Service Awards. Mount Mullen in Antarctica was named in Roy's honor for his support to the United States programs there. Roy is an emeritus fellow and honorary member of the ASPRS and has served the society in many different capacities, the most recent as the technical editor of the fifth edition of the Manual of Photogrammetry. Right now, I'd like to present Roy Mullen.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure for me to be here again to present a memorial address. I had the opportunity about 4 years ago to address the same group, not the same people, but the same function, giving a memorial address on Hugh Loving. Today, the man we're going to memorialize today, Rupert Barron Southard Jr. He was known to most of us as Rup. He was known by his many foreign friends as Rup for some reason. I don't know why. It seemed like everybody from the foreign country honorable people came, he was almost always addressed as Rup. And by a few unknowing people as Rube. He certainly was not a Rube. He was born in 1923, and like most of us, he began his life as a baby. He was born in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. He lived his entire youth there, and here we cut. There he is at about 6 years old, and there he is at about 12 years old, and there he is in high school. He was a gifted scholar and an athlete, excelling in both football and track. The Rupe we knew as an adult was not this fellow. I'm sure we all were sure. I was always sure. I never talked to him about it. I was sure that he was a big immovable guard or tackle, knowing him in his later years. Not so. He was what we would call, when I was in high school, a scat back. He was a halfback. He was a speedy young fellow, and he was a very, very gifted athlete. On the track team, he was a sprinter. He, especially being the 100-yard dash, in which he was timed more than once at 10 seconds flat, a time good enough to place him in the top three of any state championship of any of the Northeast high schools. There he is on the team, number 22, there in the front row. There he is on the track team, third from your left. Fourth from your left, sorry. There he is winning another sprint race. And not only was he a sprinter, he took time out to throw the discus. So he was a man of all kinds of talents. While at St. John, he went. His high school was St. Johnsbury Academy in St. Johnsbury. And while there, he met this certain young lady named Jean Scott. And we'll talk more about her later. He's official high school picture. That's one he, in his own handwriting on the back of that picture, I call that his Marlon Brando pose. On the back of that picture, in his own handwriting, he says, "How do you like that look on my face? Words can't describe it." And I believe he was correct there. Because of his exceptional athletic skills and his excellent academic standing, he was awarded a full scholarship in the ROTC program at the University of Rochester, New York in 1941. After completing, and that's his high school graduation picture. This is again from the University of Rochester newspaper, the campus newspaper. Not only was track and field, that's him in the upper left-hand corner. As the caption says, Rupe Southard eluding a blow from this particular fellow that he was fighting. And on the back page, it simply said, Rupe Southard, heavyweight, defeats Ellis. So after completing 2 years at Rochester, he was called to duty in the United States Marine Corps, 1944. There he is at Rochester talking to the fellow that you see in the suit on the front row is Doug DeGroot, who became a famous football coach, and that's Rupe, our man in the middle, listening intently, of course, obviously the coach. He completed boot camp, as I said, at Parris Island, South Carolina, in 1944, and he was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marines. And that's a picture of Rupe in boot camp. Picture of him in his uniform, his full dress uniform, after he'd completed officer's training up at Quantico. He left the Marine Corps that, I'm a little step ahead of myself, sorry about that. Let's put him back in the Marines. Commissioned a second lieutenant, as I say. At this point, that's when Gene Scott re-entered his life, as he and Gene were married in Quantico, and I'm not sure of the exact date of his commissioning, but I do know that you were forbidden to marry when you were in the Marine officers training at Quantico. However, I know it was tried from time to time by other people, and I'm not sure. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that Rupe and Gene somehow beat the date of his graduation, but I have no proof. He was assigned as part of the occupational force in Japan, and it was while in Japan an incident occurred that demonstrated both his character and the caring side of Rupe. He told me the story about a dog that had attached itself to his unit, and he was given the explicit instruction by his commanding officer, get rid of that dog. Rupe put the dog in his Jeep and drove it a few miles away to another group of Marines and gave it to them. And of course, you can guess what happened. Several days later, the dog reappeared in Rupe's compound, much to his chagrin and to the chagrin of his CO, who called Rupe on the carpet again and said, I said, get rid of that dog, and if you had done it the way I suspected, the dog would not have been able to return. So Rupe again had no intention of killing the dog. So he put it in his Jeep and drove it all the way across Tokyo, some 20 miles away, gave it to another unit. He lived in fear that the dog would return for about a month, but after a month, he was only then that he would feel comfortable about the situation. He was released from the Marine Corps, and he returned to pursue his education, attending Syracuse University from 1946 till 1948, graduating with a degree in civil engineering. While at Syracuse, he continued to demonstrate his athletic skill by playing football on the university football team. He studied photogrammetry under two of the most eminent photogrammetrists in the educational field, Professor Earl Church and Al Quinn. He didn't realize it at the time, but this was to be the foundation of his being, quote, discovered, and was to be his entry into the hierarchy of the national mapping activities of the United States government. On graduation, now we get him there. On graduation in 1948, he joined the Geological Survey's then Topographic Division, where he was engaged in the performance of field surveys, such as plane table topography, which he's doing here, leveling and transit traverse. He spent several years in field surveys, and then, as mentioned above, was discovered when a carpool of several headquarters personnel in this carpool was Bill Radlinsky, some of you know, said that they wished, a conversation in the carpool, said they wished they could find a formally educated photogrammetrist to come to work in the survey's research activities. Well, one of the carpool members had recently transferred in from the field and to a staff position, and he told them about this bright young engineer who met their qualifications and that he was working in the, presently in the field. An interview was arranged between Roop, Rad, and Mars Thompson, and Roop was transferred immediately to the Office of Research and Technical Standards. There, his expertise in photogrammetry was quickly recognized, and he was put to work in the development of the orthophotoscope, working with Russell K. Bean on the design and implementation. I still have the mental image of him wearing a pair of anaglyphic glasses. For all you digital cartographers, that's red and blue glasses that were used to form a stereo model, the way you could see in 3D. He was standing there with Russ Bean looking over his shoulder, a square box about 30 inches square, sitting on this, on a slate with the projectors forming the three-dimensional image. Roop working something we call a pump handle that had a cam on the end of it that simply raised and lowered that platform so that the scanning slit would be kept in constant contact with the ground, thus producing the orthographic image. It was later, that after the USGS went through several other modifications of the instrument, that more than 20,000 orthophoto quads were produced using that technology. It was during the evolution of the design of the orthophotoscope that his expert knowledge in photogrammetry was revealed. One of the precursor designs to the final working model of the orthophotoscope was something called the U60. The film was wrapped around a circular drum. The image was exposed by scanning in the X direction, stepping in the Y direction for consecutive scans. Unfortunately, or fortunately, one of the earlier orthophotos produced by this design demonstrated a major flaw in that design. As the scans proceeded in an east-west direction, the runway, there was an airport runway that was imaged in the middle of the model. As the scans proceeded in the X direction, each succeeding scan, first traveling left, then traveling right, was offset. The airport runway was offset. Instead of a straight line, it was a series of offset images. Everyone, as the curious eyes looked at this product, Roop was able to determine what exactly caused this unacceptable image. It was an excellent example of an effect called the Furch effect. And this effect is caused by the eyes fooling the brain, or vice versa, in which an imbalance in the intensity of the blue and red anaglyphic images caused the operator to dig the floating mark in one direction and to cause it to float in the other direction. This caused the alternating scans to be offset in the two succeeding designs, and Roop recognized this fact and immediately called the attention to it. And so the two succeeding designs of the USGS orthophotoscope incorporated scanning in the Y direction, where this effect is not a factor. Shortly after Roop's work was done on the orthophoto, his career took another change. His abilities to get people to work together, his consummate skills in communicating, his overall interest in all aspects of the mapping procedures and processes led to his being recognized and selected as the chief of the Office of International Activities. The survey at the time was very active in supporting the U.S. interest in the mapping of Antarctica and in the training of people from other nations in the cartographic processes. It was in the training of foreign nationals that Roop demonstrated another example of his character and his concern for other humans. An example of this is included here. Believe it or not, even in the early 1960s, Northern Virginia was not an integrated society. One of the persons who came to work to the USGS for training was from one of the African nations. It actually was not accepted for a black to eat in a restaurant in the area in Virginia where the Geological Survey's office was located. Every day at lunchtime, Roop had to send two of his employees, who were not part of the training team, up to pick up this trainee, take him several miles away to eat lunch, and return him to the office. After several days of this kind of treatment, the trainee expressed his desire to eat with the people who were training him. A restaurant directly across the street from the Atlantic region, where almost all the Geological Survey employees who didn't brown bag it bought their lunch, was called the Petit Paris. It was not integrated and was owned by a French national. Turned out he had been a friend of a U.S. officer that he'd met during the Second World War. He'd come to this country, and he had developed, among other things, a paper cup. They were called Normandy cups. He had a little fleur-de-lis on the design on the side. He eventually sold his cup-making business to Lilly Cups, who went on and made further, I call them cardboard cups, cups for coffee and things like that. Anyway, the fellow whom we all affectionately called Frenchie ran this restaurant across the street. So Roop took it upon himself to visit Frenchie, and he interceded on the trainee's behalf. The conversation is related to me by someone who was there went something like this. After Roop suggested that Frenchie could do humanity great service by allowing the trainee to eat with his colleagues, the Frenchie said, "Is this African guy really black?" Roop answered, "Yes, Frenchie, he's really dark, but you could do our country a real service by letting him eat with the rest of the USGS people who eat there." Frenchie suggested, "Maybe if you could get him to wear some sort of native dress so I could tell him, my other customer, that he's not a local black, it could be worked out. Can you do that?" Roop said he was sure something could be worked out. He even suggested that he himself, Roop, would come and eat with him, and he thanked Frenchie for, quote, "helping us out with a real problem." Frenchie's reply to Roop was, "Anytime, Roop, but not too often." In the end, the Petit Paris was integrated with Roop's intercession. Back to the career of this remarkable individual. He was on the staff. This is enough picture of it, enough to scare you to death, isn't it? Let all those people there in suits, and they called themselves surveyors and mappers. But there's our man, second from the left on them in the back row, when he was the chief of international activities. There are a couple of people in here some of you may know, and a couple of you may know. The man in the middle, Bob Ladan. Then on either side of him, the four what we called region engineers. Mars Thompson on the right, who recently passed away at the age of like 94, 96 or something like that. Roop Radlinski, two other gentlemen I'm sure none of you know, but one named John Law, who was the associate chief at the time, and Tommy Cummins, the associate region engineer in Denver, which is where this meeting was held. So he served in several, I say, more responsible positions, and he was appointed to the position assistant chief for plans and operations, where the job title aptly describes what he did. He was in charge of an office that had about 100 people, and they did the planning and the operations for all of the mapping activities in the country, gaining the requirements and setting up the program to meet the national requirements of the other federal agencies. Again, he was able to demonstrate not only his wide knowledge of the technology of mapping and its impact on the operations, and as mentioned earlier, his communication skills were superb. His ability to include a rare sense of humor into discussion eased many a tight and awkward situation. He was selected to replace the retiring Bob Ladan as the leader of the topographic division with the position title Chief Topographic Engineer. And there he is on the occasion of the announcement of that. Bill Radlinski on the right, offering Group his congratulations. In addition to managing the operations of the division, headquarters and regional mapping operations across the country, he was called on to testify before the House, Senate, and Appropriations Committees. I believe the committee members looked forward to his enlightening testimony as much as he did in giving it. The mapping program flourished under his direction, and it was during his tenure as chief that the mapping processes moved from analog to digital map production and to digital data, being the end product supplied to those users of what became, as we all know now, the geographic information systems. His accomplishments and the recognition of them are literally too many to mention. He was awarded both the Department of the Interior Meritorious and Distinguished Service Awards. One honor he received is quite singular. Two features in Antarctica are named for him. Two, not just one, two. Mount Southard, named by the United States, and Southard Promontory, named by the British Antarctic Survey. This latter naming is remarkable in a couple aspects. One, it marked the esteem with which he was held in the international mapping community. And secondly, most countries generally reserve the naming rights to their discoveries to scientists and prominent persons from their own nation. But Great Britain took it upon themselves to name Southard Promontory after our man Roop. I mentioned his unique ability to blend his sense of humor and his ability to communicate on many different occasions. He was the master of the so-called one-liners. I will cite only two of them here. There are probably two or three others that are citable, but there is a list of over 100 of them because another fellow and myself decided that we figured Roop was coming near to his days of retirement, and wouldn't we be able to do something with a bunch of those? So we started recording those one-liners. We actually reached more than 100 of them. But two of them I'll cite here. One of these especially memorable ones occurred when, after an unpopular decision was made about regarding the publication of a particular type of map, which Fred Doyle, again, who many of you know, who was a senior advisor to the chief, expressed his great concern about publishing that map. And Roop suggested to Fred, go out of the meeting, stand in the hall while the final decision is made, and come back in a minute once you've gotten your hemlock. The other was his description of how digital cartography was going to revolutionize mapping by saying, I was covered with bumps and pimples until I took digital cartographic data. And now I look like Bo Derek and I get 15 miles to the gallon more. He was full of those kinds of things. I remember another one, there was always a competition among the mapping centers, the regions, California, Denver, Rolla, the eastern region, about who could produce the most square miles of mapping every year. The central region, Rolla office, used to almost consistently win that competition. And Roop one time with a harumph said, well, why shouldn't they? You stand on a buffalo chip and you can see all the way to Denver. He served on numerous committees and commissions. He presented keynote addresses to foreign national professional societies. He chaired the Committee on Cartography of the Pan American Institute of Geography and History. He was the U.S. representative to numerous United Nations conferences on cartography for Africa, the Americas, and Southeast Asia. He was the Department of the Interior representative on the Office of the Managed and Budgets Federal Mapping Task Force, comprised of representatives of the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Commerce, Department of Defense, and was chaired by Wilkie Donaldson of the Office of the President's Executive Office of the Management Budget. And there they were charged with looking at ways to coordinate and improve mapping government-wide on the civilian side. This followed very shortly after the study that put most of the old Army Map Service, ACIC, Navy Hydrographic Office together into the Defense Mapping Agency. So many recommendations were made regarding these possibilities of integrating mapping, charting, and geodesy. The major recommendation was the creation of a central mapping, cartographic, and geographic agency, which we shall call, this is directly out of the report, which we would call the Federal Survey Administration. Unfortunately, that report went to the office of the president at the most inopportune time. It was never fully implemented, and it was lost in the political turmoil associated with the Nixon administration. He taught photogrammetry. He team-taught photogrammetry 1 and 2 at the Department of Agriculture for more than 12 years. I know he team-taught because I was part of the other team for about 8 of those years. He and I would alternate nights. We had 16 subjects. We had probably, in those 12 years, we had about 280 employees of various federal agencies and some from some of the local businesses in which we taught photogrammetry 1 and 2, and there was a photogrammetry 3 taught by a fellow, Mort Keller, from the Department of Commerce, and Carp T. Winkle, again, whom many of you know. After all of his involvement in the mapping of the and management of the National Mapping Program, you could wonder how he found time to get involved with other community activities, but he did, with noticeable results. He was the choir director of the St. Louis Catholic Church, both directing and singing in the choir. He organized and coached the St. Louis High School track and field teams. He was a member of the he was also called upon many times. Everybody at the Geological Survey wanted Roop to be the master of ceremonies. Say his sense of humor, his wit, his singing voice, everything. That's it. Retirement, I'm not even sure whose retirement that is. It might have been George Whitmore, who is hiding there down just to the right of Roop. He performed, sang, there he is in the center, singing a song at George Whitmore's retirement. Two people down to Roop's right is, again, Bill Radlinski, a few other people, an unknown notable on Roop's right, or standing on Roop's right on your left. That fellow was named Herb Nelson, and he became famous because one of his sons became one of the Muppets. So anyway, that's Roop. But there he is being presented award for the his work as the with the track and field team at St. Leo's. So he was the choir director of the St. Leo's Catholic Church, both directing and singing in the choir. He organized and coached the track team, as I mentioned. He was a member of the Fairfax Players. I think that picture that we showed earlier of him in his Marlon Brando pose was probably a portent of what was going to happen later on. He was in the local theater group where, among other roles, he played in The Death of the Salesman. He encountered another interlude in his life when he was recalled to the Marines at the end of the Korean War. And there was an article in the newspaper about it, and I'm sorry I didn't copy it, but it probably wouldn't have been too readable anyway. But it said this article in which a St. Johnsbury was in a St. Johnsbury newspaper with saying he was recalled by saying, Southard is remembered here as a prominent athlete and a notable singer. He served on board a ship in the Mediterranean in this time before returning to the USGS to resume his government career. He was a devoted family man. As Bill mentioned, they had six children. With Jean, they raised six children, two girls, Ann, who's with us today, and her late sister Kathleen, and four boys, John, who's with us, Timothy, who's with us, and Matthew, Joe is with us. John, his fourth son, lives and works in Germany, and he's not here with us today. But Timothy and Joe are. Their son, Matthew, just underwent some heart procedures yesterday. And as a matter of fact, Joe was concerned, and I was concerned too, that perhaps they wouldn't be able to be here today. But they made an extraordinary effort, and they are here with us. I'm glad to recognize that they are here. The man we're honoring today, that's a picture of Gene and Roop. I wish I had the other picture now right next to it, the one of he and Gene at St. Johnsbury 40-some years earlier, but I don't. This was a trip they'd made to Italy, and that was Roop and Gene on a vacation trip. The man we're honoring today, Rupert Barron Southern, was an outstanding talent. I went to the dictionary to ensure that I was making the right attribution when I used the term Renaissance man. I could believe you can agree with me, words directly quoted from the dictionary. Renaissance man obviously was first, the first definition came during the time of the Renaissance, and it says, the typical educated, cultured man of the Renaissance who because of his knowledge of the world, was generally limited, was able to know everything there was to know about a great variety of given subjects. Well, that fits, but it doesn't. Roop wasn't born in the Renaissance time. The second definition, perfect. A present-day man with many broad interests who has the opportunity to indulge himself in them so as to acquire a knowledge of each that is more than superficial. A perfect description of the man we honor today, Rupert Barron Southern Jr. Roop died on September 23rd, 1999, was preceded in death by his beloved wife, Jean. With that, I give you Roop Southern. A couple things that aren't in the written text, but I wanted to just relate to you. If you hadn't guessed, I was his associate. I was associate for about 9 years. One of the greatest periods of time in my career spent with him because he was a wonderful man to work with. He decided that he would like to run the more or less outside operations of the survey. And since I had been a region engineer in California myself from 72 to 76 and was very familiar with the operations, he said, why don't you kind of run the inside operations? We only had two things ever happened where there was a word between us. One, he admonished me one time when he gave one of his one-liners, and I actually one-upped him with a one-liner right on top of his, and he said, Roy, do I need to remind you there's only room for one comedian in the office of the chief? Well, that passed by. Quite a few years later, as he was off on one of his trips, I used to sign a lot of the actions and decision documents and so forth and so on. There were some documents that required his signature. We both knew it required his signature. But sometimes he wasn't available, and I'd got so good at his signature that this event actually occurred. A question came up about an action that had been signed off on several years before. He brought it to me, and he said, you know, he said, Roy, he said, I don't remember signing this thing, but obviously I did. There's my signature. I said, well, Roop, the reason you don't remember it, I said, that's not your signature, that's mine. He said, look, I know my signature, that's my signature. I said, Roop, I said, I hate to disagree with you. And I said, this is the only time we ever use the word disagree between us. I said, that's my signature. I know it. He said, well, I know I don't remember it, but he said, I know that's my signature. That's enough. I don't know. Thank you. Thank you.
On behalf of the Memorial Address Committee and all in the audience, I thank you for your time and effort and helping us remember one of our really distinguished professionals. Let's give him another hand. Thank you. And thank you again to the family. It's very nice to have you here.